Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York, partnering with Grow NYC to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets. For more information, visit christmastreesny.org.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacigo, on this weekly journey through culinary history. And you know, butter has gone through a rough life. They've had a bad rap. They're either the enemy or they're the savior, and then back again, kind of like salt. You never know, should I eat it? Shouldn't I eat it? And I think we now have some pretty definitive answers on fat and particularly butter. And even better, I've got a butter expert here today. Joining me today, Elaine Kosrova. And Elaine has written the book, Butter, A Rich History, Rich Indeed. She went to the CIA as a pastry chef in the pastry program and became a pastry chef, and also holds a BS in food and nutrition. She began her career in food publishing as a test kitchen editor at Country Living magazine and then continued writing and her work appeared in many different magazines. Then something interesting happened. She got interested in another milk product, cheese, and she helped found a magazine called Culture, all about cheese. Her work with that and her specialization in cheese led, I think, to her interest in butter, but we will find out. Mm-hmm. And the book is really quite a complete history. Welcome, Elaine.
Thank you. Thank you, Linda.
So did indeed cheese led to your obvious interest in butter? I mean, that's...
Yes, because, I mean, I started to notice before Culture that there were, you know, if you could get some imported butters and some artisanal butters, there was different things going on with them, you know. So I was kind of fascinated by the craft and science of butter even before Culture. But when I got to the magazine, that really helped me, you know, understand what was going on in the dairy world. I spent almost 5 years behind the scenes, you know, meeting the animals, the farmers, the processing. And so I could then understand that butter is this sort of confluence of man and land and animal that's so unique because it's so fresh. You know, unlike cheese, which can have quite a lot of manipulation, butter is quite simple and pure. So it's kind of this direct communication about those three things.
Yeah, almost like milk itself. I mean, just, you know, we were talking before the show about milk and what's happening to the milk industry and how highly, you know, it's such a highly perishable product.
Exactly.
Butter then comes second, and of course then cheese.
Yeah. But then the butter maker brings a lot to the process. It makes it super interesting too. So I love, you know, the variations in the butter world and kind of reading butters for them, studying butters, see what's going on.
Well, it used to be an easy process going to the store and picking up your pound of butter. Today, you look at the butter aisle and there are butters galore. And they'll have all kinds of names and designations and countries of origin. And now we have a lot of artisanal butters being made. Would you call them artisanal butters being made?
Small batch butters. Okay. Some of them are artisanal.
Yeah. It makes the selection process a little daunting, but
this
book helps sort things out for me.
Yeah.
But I guess really it gets down to taste, right?
You know, I've developed a real fondness for cultured butters, although, you know, this a sweet cream butter is still the most popular, you know, for most people. That is definitely the most popular butter. And it's, you know, it can be nutty and beautiful and very simple in its delectability, whereas cultured butter, I think because I spent so much time with cheese, you know, I appreciate that little bit of acidity that you get with that variety. But it is, as you said, there's so many choices. It's a great time to be a butter lover.
Well, let's go back to the beginning, the way beginning. I think the story, you tell the story in a very, I think, half humorous, but yet accurate way. I mean, through accidental churning. I mean, who hasn't taken a pint of cream to whip it into whipped cream and started talking to, you know, somebody, and you turn around and go, whoops.
Yeah, and then some people throw it away not realizing that it's butter. They've created butter.
Well, tell us the story that you, if you would, share the one that was told in the book.
Well, this is about, you know, the first butter, if there ever was an actual first. I think more likely that it happened in different places around the world rather than one place and then spread out. But essentially what we believe, you know, what food historians believe and anthropologists, archaeologists, is that it began with nomadic people who would have kept sheep and goats because those are very comfort-loving animals. They're easier to domesticate. And so it's likely that the first butters happened with sheep or goat milk. And the story that I tell in the book is that a shepherd collects the milk from the animals and then it sits overnight and it chills a little bit. It would have been kept inside an animal sack, like a goat skin, because that's not porous. And so it's cooling down and it's culturing a little bit inside the sack. And then the next day the shepherd, you know, loads it on his back or the back of the animals and takes a journey, you know, to the next valley. And
through the rocky hills.
Right. Rocky hills. And so it's rocked back and forth and it's essentially churned. And lo and behold, you know, he opens his sack and there's these delicious, rich morsels of fat.
And of course, not going to throw anything away.
Not at all. Yes, exactly. And those butters would have been white in color, by the way. The sheep butter and goat butter. So it wouldn't have been golden pieces like we
have. Now, that was a question I had as we got on to some of the other butters. You say that would have been white. And I thought, now does that have to do with where they were grazing, what they were eating, or the enzymes and fats and
it actually has to do with the animal's metabolism, how they take nutrients in. So all these animals, cows, goats, sheep, they all take in plant matter, which has beta-carotene, but the cow stores the beta-carotene in their tissue, and then when they are making milk, it comes out of their tissue into the milk, and beta-carotene is naturally yellow. These other animals take the beta-carotene from the plant and convert it to vitamin A, because it's very close, you know, it's like a little step, and it's vitamin A, and that's colorless. So it's the same nutrient. You can have the same.
So either way, you're getting it. Right?
The nutrient is there, but it doesn't have color, which I think is kind of amazing.
Interesting. Yeah.
So you know, shouldn't look. You can look at a cow's butter and say, "Wow, that's really pale." They didn't have a lot of beta carotene in their diet, which is true. But you can't do that with other butter, you know, sheep and goat and water buffalo. Those are naturally white.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize that. And yet it's known that the Irish breed, some of the herds have, their butter is much much more pronounced yellow color.
Oh, yeah.
From the beta-carotene.
Oh, yes. When you talk about cows, it's a completely different thing, you know.
Well, we're not there yet. It's too early in history.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, they didn't domesticate cows for a long... Well, they need, especially time. They're nomadic, because cows need... You know, can have one cow maybe and walk them along, but not a herd of cows.
And even when they did domesticate them, they tend to use them for plowing fields and things like that. They didn't become a dairy animal till much later.
So when we're talking about these early nomadic tribes who milked their sheep or goat and then made the butter, about how long ago are we talking?
Oh, well, you know, they're still figuring out domestication, trying to nail it down. I think we're talking about 9,000 years ago.
Okay.
Very long time ago. Mm-hmm.
And actually, you mentioned in the book that paleontologists or archaeologists found some proof of this from centuries ago, like 4,000 or more years ago, mm-hmm. of the sacks that they were churning the butter in, right?
The sacks and the containers, you know, the clay containers can actually hold some of this dairy enzymes, dairy matter. It's like buried inside the clay. So that's pretty recent, actually, that they've been able to examine them and find this proof of dairying way back when.
And didn't I read that they built sort of a tripod thing, like a baby's rocker?
For butter making. So it moved off, you know, when they figured out, oh, we can maybe make this happen intentionally.
Rather than tying it to our mule.
Are remote communities, I believe, you know, in the Middle East where they still, and they're nomadic for the most part, these people still use this primitive tripod of, you know, three twigs, essentially, you know, sticks from trees. And hang a sack filled with milk and just rock it back and forth.
Rock it back and forth until it's butter.
I mean, it's absolutely like primordial butter.
Very interesting, yeah. So back to the diet of these, you posed a very interesting question to one of the scientists that you used to research your book, and you said, well, how can this animal on such a totally vegetarian diet, mm-hmm. albeit with several stomachs chewing many times, produce this product that is so high in these wonderful globules of fat?
Yeah. Yeah, I call it the Rumpelstiltskin effect. Because I live by farms and pass these cows, you know, chewing on the land, and it's always kind of, filled me with wonder, you know, how they give us such rich stuff from this fairly lean diet. And it's all because of the their anatomy and chemistry, their biochemistry and anatomy. They have this stomach with four compartments, and it's a fermentation process that essentially breaks down the plant matter, you know, to its most basic carbon units, really, really basic, and it reassembles them into what's called volatile acids, and that's the basis for creating fatty acids. So it's just completely stripping it down to, you know, the most fundamental molecules and rebuilding it into fat. And it's, you know, something they just do really well. It's
obviously
remarkable.
Yeah. That is quite remarkable. Although some animals do produce milk that's higher in fat than others, and you mentioned particularly the water buffalo.
The water buffalo does. The sheep produces milk that's about three times more fat than cow's milk. In fact, I know a sheep butter maker who struggled to make butter until she realized her milk was actually too fatty. It's ironic that, you know, she actually had to skim off some of the fat in her milk so it would churn, because of this. Too much fat, your butter won't come. I know it sounds very counterintuitive, but it's true.
Yes, it does.
And then there's reindeer milk, which is actually, you can make butter out of, the Laplanders made butter out of reindeer milk. It's a very small amount of milk, but it's super rich. Super rich. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so before you throw out that whey, after you've made your mozzarella or whatever, you know, just think twice, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you have a reindeer around. And the diet, back to the diet again, you talk about a lot of things that, well, farmers have learned, obviously, through, you know, chemistry and biology and so much more about what they're feeding the animals and how to produce better butters or butters with a different flavor. Mm-hmm. And you said yourself you learned a lot of new terminology for some of these items they were feeding them.
Yes.
What talk about that in the diet and how they sort of affect the flavors?
Yes. Well, and again, what I discovered too is that different animals eat different things. You know, the sheep and goats really like more stubbly, coarse matter. They're not so much grass eaters. They like, I think it's called browse and orbs. That's the terminology. So they're often eating different things than what a cow would be eating. So as far as, you know, when I went to Ireland, that's when I really became aware of, you know, the fact that for a lot of dairy farmers, their work is about the grass. It's about building up a beautiful grass for pasture, and the animals will essentially take care of the rest. That, you know, one farmer in particular said, I'm really a grass farmer, because if I keep amending the soil and, you know, adding certain seeds and clover and making a super beautiful grass, then my butter will be fine.
Cows will be happy.
Cows will be happy. So he... You know, you think of dairy farmers as paying attention to the animals, but in fact, there's so much that's involved in their pasture work.
Well, and as he said, starts with the soil. I mean, have really good soil and good nutrients in the soil, and no harmful.
Well, that too, of course. Additives. Yeah, the purity of it, but even just from a flavor point of view, and making sure there's not things like wild onions that will, you know, make the butter have an off flavor. You know, they found ancient butter in Ireland. I'm sure you've probably heard of bog butter.
Yeah,
And some of it still has a garlicky essence to it, even after hundreds of years.
Because it was just wild. They were eating
in
the wild. All right, talk about bog butter. I'm sure that a lot of listeners aren't aware of the story behind bog butter.
Yeah, so...
First of all, you got your butter,
okay,
and you need to keep it, not refrigerated as we do today. I mean, that changed the industry, too. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
But you have to keep it fresh.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And
yes. So the ancient Irish, you know, people that were living there, even before it was called Ireland, I believe, you know, it was a very tribal place with... the very early settlers there, indigenous people rather. Anyway, so old Ireland, you know, they're dairying, they're making butter, and they put it essentially in these primitive wooden barrels, and they bury it in the bog because the bog is very acidic and no oxygen. You know, it's essentially a great place to preserve practically anything.
Hmm.
They've pulled out a few old bodies, in fact, that have been preserved
next
for a long
to the
time. Hopefully not. So, this was a means of preservation, but what I discovered in my research was that they found, so this was happening for at least 1,000 years. You know, they were burying their butter in the bog to preserve it, we assumed. But now they've done a sort of map of where these discoveries are, where the bog butter is being found, and they've realized that it's on the boundaries of very important sort of sacrificial sites, you know, sites that had to do with the fairies and the elementals and the gods, you know, certain areas that were kind of sacred. And they believe that many of the bog butters were a pagan offering then to, you know, to the elementals and the spirits. So it was a sort of a peace offering, which really makes a lot of sense to me because butter was so valuable. You know, I can't imagine that they would just bury it and forget it or leave it, you know.
Well, I moved on, but I forgot my stash of butter,
right?
Gotta go dig it up. That is a perfect lead-in to talking about some of the other... spiritual or mystic kind of connections. Attributions to butter. Butter, I never knew that butter, and not that I knew that much about butter anyway, compared to all these facts that you're throwing out here, mm-hmm. but that butter had such a rich history in terms of, well, you just mentioned, it was a valuable item. You figure you have all this milk, you get a little bit of butter. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants the butter, so there's a high price to pay for it.
Yes.
And it becomes like gold, right? It's gold.
Well, and that was actually another reason that they did bury it, was to protect it from the overlords who would come in and want to take the butter. So there was another reason to stash it. But butter had this incredibly rich metaphysical life way back when. You know, I was amazed to discover that around the world, ancient peoples used butter as a sacred tool in their spiritual practice. I mean, it was the Sumerians, the Vedic Aryans, the Hindus, the Buddhists, the Druids, they all had these different rituals that involved using butter. That was one big surprise. And, some of them were quite simple. The Vedic Aryans worshipped a fire god named Agni, and they would take ghee, which is clarified butter, mm-hmm. and they would sprinkle it on the flames when they were in the midst of their worship. And the flames, of course, would crackle and dance. And they would recite these verses that were, I mean, I have one in my book. It's essentially poetry about butter and how butter makes the gods happy, and, you know, streams of flowing butter. And it's really quite remarkable. Yeah, so I found that, you know, there were all these beautiful ways people appreciated butter beyond eating it, you know, beyond its commodity value for them.
Right. And then, of course, there were also, you write a lot about the sculptures, the Tibetan butter sculptures.
Yes.
Did you actually see them?
Well, yes, not the ones in Tibet. I did not get to Tibet. You know, I went to Bhutan.
Tell us about how this came about and what this is.
The sculptures?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I was doing research into the early, life of butter, and came across, again, many of these different practices. And I had, I went online to look at Tibetan butter sculptures, because there's quite a lot that you can see online, all these elaborate, detailed, beautiful sculptures. They're actually called tormas, and, they're created to be put on an altar so that when the Buddhists are having a festival or a particular event to honor a deity or to set an intention, it becomes the centerpiece of what they're doing. So it's a really important fixture in their practice. So I went online to find out more about it, and just actually contacted a monastery across the river from here where I live, and I was put in touch with a woman who is an expert on torma carving. That's what it's called. She actually created a film about it, and I visited with her. She's a Buddhist nun, and I went and spent an entire day looking at her footage and learning all about the different techniques involved. And, the sculptures that she showed me were mostly footage from India, where the Tibetan Buddhists have been are in exile, and because it's India and because of the heat, they've had to modify the traditional form. So there's some butter mixed with margarine, mixed with a little paraffin. In Tibet, for centuries, it was just yak butter and flour that formed the paste that they used to do these elaborate, beautiful carvings. But it's been modified in India. I mean, the practice hasn't changed at all, but the material is different. And it's not as it doesn't melt away in the same way that the original tormas made of yak butter and flour would melt away. And that's actually that's intentional. Just in the same way Buddhists have sand mandalas that are meant to
temporary.
Dissipate.
Right.
That was the great thing, that they felt was wonderful about butter sculptures, is it didn't become this permanent thing. That it eventually melted away, and then you have to rebuild, and it comes back. It's very much a Buddhist way of thinking. Things are transient, and so lots to see. And I have gorgeous pictures. I so wish my book had full color photography.
Well, we'll just you'll have to have a website where you put some of these beautiful things up there.
A blog.
It's interesting because you you talked about the butter sculptures melting and that was intentional. And it was sort of like some people felt, maybe it was in the 6th century, I think it was the 6th century, there was a spiritual feeling that the act of, that butter making was a was a special spiritual act, that it was a metaphor for the stages of development or something.
Exactly, like, because essentially from, you know, milk you get cream, from cream you get butter, from butter you can get ghee. I mean, for many of these cultures they used ghee, and so, you know, this kind of symbolized this evolution that you could keep refining and refining, you know, your soul, in the same way that dairy is refined to make this beautiful golden object at the end. So it was very, very symbolic.
Interesting. Yeah. Well, we're going to talk more about some of this ancient butter and bring us up to date on modern day butter as well when we come back after a short break.
Ever wonder where your Christmas tree came from? Now you don't have to. New York State-grown Christmas trees are now available in New York City. Trees grown on farms here in New York State are harvested just a few days before arrival to the city. Trees cut close to home stay fresh longer, and trees cut close to home travel less, which reduces fuel consumption of delivery vehicles. Did you know that buying a real tree helps to sustain agriculture in New York State by supporting local farmers and keeping important open space in agriculture production? The Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York is partnering with Grow NYC to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets in Brooklyn, Queens, and Manhattan. So when you shop local this holiday season, you can include the tree in that list. For more information and a full list of locations, visit ChristmasTreesNY.org.
Hi, we're back, and I'm talking with Elaine Kusrova about butter, a rich history, very rich indeed, and very tasty also. Who knew that there was so much mysticism involved with butter and special things? Well, then, of course, we were talking about, you know, ancient times, but even up through the 15th, 16th century. I mean, starting in, well, probably in the 13th, but even around Martin Luther, you know, the Roman Catholic sumptuary laws that would prohibit anything, you know, during fast days. And butter became this exalted, prohibited item.
Yes, right.
People would pay money to have the excuse to be able to eat it.
They did. It was kind of an extortion, honestly, by the church.
But of course, they said you could use oil. And they were thinking, you know, Mediterranean people were thinking olive oil because they had a lot of it, right?
Yeah, it was really unfair when you think about the fasting decrees, because the people in the South, you know, they had fish, they had oil, you know, they had a almost year-round growing season. You know,
they
had a lot of vegetables. They did fine with the fasting, but in the North, they completely depended on animal products so much for, you know, for their sustenance. So, you know, it was kind of a starvation, you know, that they eventually revolted against, but it took about 100 years. So in that process, there was this decree that if you pay a certain amount of money, you can enjoy your butter. I just found that so terrible.
Even though it's a fast day, you can eat butter if you give me $500.
Right. No, and it wasn't, I think, until about 1490. It was famous queen, I'm forgetting her name right now, but she petitioned Rome, you know, for clemency. You have to, you know, we're suffering here. You have to let us have our butter.
Yeah, interesting.
And, eventually she won over, and then the other countries followed suit.
Well, that good thing, because
yeah.
And it's funny because then look what happens, you know, fast forward, and we're all eschewing butter and saying, no, we're only going to make do with olive oil. Well, because now olive oil is accessible to everybody.
Yes.
You know, everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere.
And, you know, and oh, no, butter is a bad thing, you know. And so, as I said at the top of the show, I was like, now we're reversed things and butter's okay to eat. Well, and they said it. It's been shown to fight against heart disease and some cancer.
Yes, I know. The science is so...
Osteoporosis, all kinds of things.
The science is just so much better now.
Well, it's hard to know what to believe from one year to the next. But as Julia Child always said, everything in moderation.
I know.
I'm a great believer in that. Yes. I really am.
I believe so. Yeah, I'm definitely follow that creed.
Well, so many things came into being in modern times, modern times being, you know, late 1800s on, that really changed butter for us, being in the Industrial Revolution. I mean,
the period of the late 1800s was a massive game changer in the butter world, because essentially butter left home, it left the farm. It had always been on the farm, and for as long as it was farming. And then with the invention of the cream separator, which was the late 1880s, that shifted everything, because now people could take milk and instantly separate the cream portion from the liquid portion by a process of centrifugal force. And with that, you know, before the cream separator, they would wait hours, 12 to 24 hours for the milk to set and then the cream to rise and then skim the cream off. So
I love to do. You open up, a jar of milk, whole milk, natural.
Nice raft of cream
on top.
Get that,
the cap of cream on top. What a treat.
Yeah. But that would take many, many hours, so it slowed down the whole process. So once the cream separator was invented, farmers were now just taking their milk to a local creamery, a local plant, and there it was separated, and they would make butter right there at the plant. And so that, you know, that was the beginning of industrializing butter in the late 1880s.
And then they would, and then refrigeration came along.
Yes,
and
right.
I've done,
that was a big,
a nice show on that. Yes. It just changed our world totally.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, it's really true. That period was remarkable. You had refrigeration, the cream separator, margarine shows up. You know, so many things that radically changed.
Margarine. Let's just dispense quickly with that, as we did in history. But why did margarine come about? Let's just do a quickie on margarine, because I think that...
Yeah, yeah.
So, those of us who remember back when were raised, many of us raised on margarine.
But the margarine you were raised on was nothing like the original margarine, which was invented by a French chemist. And he, Napoleon III at the time had issued created a contest for someone to create a butter alternative for his soldiers, something that was more portable and cheaper and easier.
And once again, cheaper. Yeah.
Price
came into
exactly.
it.
Exactly. So this French chemist came up with this mixture of beef fat, milk, salt, and some annatto, some food coloring, mixed it all together, and voila, that was the first margarine. It's called Oleo. And so, you know, that when that came on the scene, and it evolved, you know, the flavors evolved, but it wasn't until the 20th century that it became a vegetable oil-based product. So it took some time to evolve. And often they would actually mix this meat, you know, this beef-based product with some natural butter and get what's called a butterine product. So there was a lot of creativity there going on. But margarine just, you know, changed. It just started this 90-year-long battle that was brutal. I mean, it's vicious. It was incredible that the butter makers used, you know, push for any kind of regulations or legislation or taxation, anything that would cripple the margarine producers.
Yeah, I mean, it was putting them out of... People would use it not only just in their... to spread on their toast, but for baking and for, you know, cooking, general, everything.
Yeah.
Right. Where was the flavor? Where was the good fat?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And and they would tout and see, this was interesting. And all the ads would tout health benefits of margarine over butter and how false that was, right?
Yeah, well, now we know. That's kind of tragic, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we can do away with that. That's enough, enough on margarine. But we, along with, you mentioned the Industrial Revolution was a game changer. I mean, that including refrigeration and the cream separator, you have these huge mechanical churners.
Mm. Yes. Well, that was post-war, essentially. Yeah, post-Second World War. You have what's called a continuous churn was developed, or also called a butyrator. And these are fully automated, gigantic machines that now, today, can make about 22,000 pounds of butter per hour. Mm. And, you know, the original ones didn't do that much, but... they've evolved.
22,000 pounds an hour. That's
so. Butter is essentially goes from cream to butter in about 3 seconds. Huh. 3 seconds. So compare that with a commercial batch churn, which is another way that we get a lot of our commodity butter.
Think
still
of it
being
as
done.
Small batch butter, kind of like small batch.
Well, there's. There, a batch churn can be small, but it also can be very big. You know, I visited ones, creameries, where they have batch churns that are about the size of a small garage.
Oh.
but they look like a giant clothes dryer. They're big, round, you know, cylindrical churns with a window. And those have been in operation, you know, since the 20s. I mean, they used to be wood, now they're stainless steel, many of them. They take about an hour to make butter. So here you have, you know, even within the same commercial industry, some people making it in 3 seconds, other people take an hour to make butter.
What is there any discernible difference in the small? When did you say small?
The batch churn,
not small. Yeah. Batch churn and continuous churn.
Well, there's many things that affect the texture and flavor of a butter. And what I have discovered that I can say for certain is that the industrial churns, these big ones, before the cream even goes into the churn, it goes through this tempering process where they essentially take the butter to a certain temperature, drop it, take it up again. And what that does, it's kind of brilliant actually, is that they're modifying the construction of the fat molecule, because every fat molecule has liquid and crystalline fats. And if you have too much liquid fat in them, you get a greasy butter. Mm-hmm. If you have too much crystalline fat, you get a crumbly butter. So this tempering process that they've figured out, you know, precisely, gives it just the right ratio. And that's why so much of our beautiful supermarket butter some of it's beautiful, some of it's not, but a lot of it has this beautiful velvety texture. You know, it's very cohesive, it's very spreadable. That's a modern phenomenon, and it's very much a benefit of the industrial system. You know, batch churn butter can be quite smooth and beautiful too. And oftentimes, you know, the ratio, you just get lucky. But there's also, you know, some batch churn butters that are not as cohesive. You know, they're just not quite as, that's sort of, I keep coming back to the word velvety.
Mm. Well, and then let's talk about cultured butters.
Mm, right.
What creates a cultured butter? I mean, I know very well from the Vermont Creamery butter is a well-known cultured butter that you can find on the supermarket shelf.
Right.
Several other brands, I'm sure.
From, yeah.
You have a nice list in the back of your book.
I do,
Of butters.
You go back in history, every butter was cultured.
That's what I was asking. What would it look like? What would the butter in history look like to us or taste like to us?
Yeah,
like a cultured butter.
Quite strong, some of it, considering it was raw milk. They didn't have refrigeration, and it went through this natural culturing process that happened because the milk was being set out. You know, it's set out for 12 to 24 hours. The lactic bacteria, which is everywhere in a dairy, it's just naturally present, it would have been culturing and fermenting the milk. And so you know, it really wasn't, again, until we had the cream separator that suddenly we had a new kind of cream that was super fresh, like instantly fresh. That was like a new product. Mm. So culturing now is a decision. You know, you either make it sweet or you decide that you're going to inoculate the cream with different bacterial cultures. And that's been done in Europe, you know, continuous, particularly France. There's many cultured butters. That's a tradition there. But it's a pretty new thing now in the States here. People in China.
You told the story of the guy who was making virgin butter.
Yeah.
Which was, I thought was rather humorous, but dipping your hands.
Yeah. He was making a girl.
Talking about the bacteria that's everywhere that gets into the butter.
You know, the girl butter careful. And the boy butter.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. His name is Patrick Johansson, also known as the Butter Viking. And he's a Swedish guy. Very, by far the most interesting butter maker that I interviewed and met with, you know, in all my research, because he's constantly tinkering with this process, particularly around the bacteria. He's just constantly adjusting, making little adjustments to acidity and temperature and time. One of his experiments, he's also got a good sense of humor, was to make a girl butter and a boy butter. And he went to a restaurant where he was delivering his butter with two vats of cream, and he had the guys, you know, put their hand in one vat of cream and the girls put their hand in the other vat of cream, and, you know, then took them
back.
So
there they introduced some interesting bacteria
into
them.
Some lactic bacteria, yeah. Because apparently it's present all around us.
I'm sure.
It's on us. And he says that the girl butter was delicious, but the boy butter was not.
There you go, girls. Well, and right. It only stands to reason because mm-hmm. back in the, not ancient times, but old times,
yeah.
only women were allowed
yes.
to milk the cows, right?
Yes, it was taboo almost universally for men to have anything to do with dairying. It was very much a female domain because it was so connected to birth and fertility mm-hmm. and lactation. You know, it's very much a feminine thing.
And hence the maidens with the yoke of
yeah,
wooden milk
right.
pails and
exactly,
know, walking around.
Hardy women.
I mean, it's
yes.
a great, it's just a great image, you know,
yes.
of the women
yeah.
milk maidens. But yes, thank goodness that there is industrialization in that regard.
Well, yeah, it's true. But, you know, women also developed, you know, they gained a certain status from the fact that they made butter. Butter was valuable, and mm-hmm. butter was also kind of mysterious.
Beer. They were beer makers, too. Women were
yeah.
primarily the beer makers.
I yeah.
mean, well,
yeah. So, you know, I mean, yeah.
So watch out. We'll cut off your butter. I'll cut off your beer. Better be
yeah.
nice, right?
No, I often say that the whole dairy industry grew up on the shoulders of women.
Yeah.
That's true.
Absolutely.
Around the world.
Yeah. And scotch, too, I think. You know, bourbons. Yeah, we're
really
yeah
oh,
not scotch necessarily, but bourbons.
Oh.
Yeah, but women were some of the early and strongest,
mm-hmm.
And still are
batch
bourbon makers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's so much,
yes.
so much. We could just
yes.
I could take you through the entire book, but then you wouldn't have anything to read. You
right,
see,
exactly. Yeah,
but I think that it is an interesting test for our listeners. Is next time you go and buy your butter, whatever butter, and I'm sure mm-hmm. everyone sort of has a favorite, but
yes.
when you're buying your butter, and especially now at this holiday season that we're in, mm-hmm. everyone's using lots and lots of butter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's good for you. Everything in moderation,
right.
remember.
Right. It's true.
But look at the label. Does it usually say on the let's say more of a commodity kind of butter? Well, no, Land O'Lakes has
mm-hmm.
different brands, but
yeah.
look, does it tell you what the, not the origin, but how it was made or when it was made?
Not so much. In fact, some industrial producers are adding diacetyl to the butters, which is diacetyl is what gives butter its distinct butteriness.
Is it a flavor additive? Sort
so it's
of
a flavor additive. It's, but it's listed as a natural flavor. So basically, they're boosting what's already in butter. You know, diacetyl is naturally in butter, so they're adding more of that to give it a stronger butteriness. And so, but you won't see diacetyl because that would scare people. You know,
mm-hmm.
so they just say natural flavoring. So it's. If you're going to have, you know, a butter tasting or compare butters, it's it's not really fair to compare one that has this kind of amped up diacetyl component with one that hasn't.
Natural,
you know,
just
yeah. So, you know, you want a butter. Again, if you're comparing apples to apples, you want a butter that just says cream, salt. You know, that's really natural.
Mm-hmm. And do a separate tasting for cultured butters. That should
yes,
be just, you know,
absolutely cultured.
Culture against culture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although here, that's another whole thing to tease apart, because what I discovered really, really surprised me is that cultured butter, again, I discussed how the vat is of cream is inoculated with mm-hmm. with the bacteria, and it's left to sit for 18 to 24 hours, you know, to get this nice tanginess. So it's this long process. And back in the 70s, the big guys, the big butter makers, particularly in Europe, I think it was Denmark who figured this out, that they could just make sweet butter quickly without waiting for anything to culture, and then they could just inject a lactic flavoring, essentially. It's natural, but they just simply inject it into the butter, and it's called cultured butter. Even though it's not actually, it's not gone through the traditional process. I mean, it still tastes fine. Yeah. And you can't argue against the flavor of it. But I think of all the butter makers that are going through the traditional process, you know, and really monitoring the bacteria, because it's not that easy to do. You know, the cream changes through the seasons, and it just seems so unfair that there's not a designation for that.
Yeah.
And some butter makers, I know Sierra Nevada, for instance, they make cultured butter, and they specifically say vat cultured. So if there was a designation, that would be it.
Well, if you can find it and you look for it, but look for some smaller makers and mm-hmm. compare the different types if you're interested in tasting the butter.
Yes.
It's phenomenal. It really does. You can taste so many differences when you, you know, you start
and
focusing
texture
on it.
Too.
Yeah.
Texture is
yeah.
really fun. Yeah.
Elaine, thank you so much. This is so interesting. And I, as I say, I urge my listeners to look at their butter packages, but also take a look at the book. It is, it's
please.
Just got so much fun history in it. It's really.
And recipes.
And I forgot to mention,
that's
just sort of an extra added bonus there, but they are delicious recipes, indeed.
Yeah.
Butter recipes, who needs it? Just eat the butter, but the recipes are wonderful. And
you're
getting it from a former pastry chef, so there you go.
A great pie crust for the holidays.
That's another initiative for you and for him to get the book. All right, thanks. Elaine Kosarova, and the book again is Butter, A Rich History.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. This has been A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palaccio. And be sure to tune in to Heritage Radio Network for so many more wonderful programs. And if you are so inspired, go to our website at heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart in the upper right-hand corner. Every little bit helps. We are listener-supported. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world, or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.